Let me ask if you would take your own Bible, if you brought it, or the pew Bible that's in front of you, and open to Psalm 139. We have already heard much, indeed probably most of this psalm this morning, in either a choral fashion from the choir or read earlier. But please do open to this psalm, this familiar psalm, 139. And have it before you for the next several minutes. Thank you. Well, I went looking for Barbara's Valentine card the other day. I wonder if you've ever noticed that men are often a bit self-conscious about buying Valentine Day cards. That's actually why I go early. I like to avoid the lineup of men looking through rows of cards with hearts and flowers on them. Some guys have the quick approach, what I call the snatch-and-go method. It's as if they're picking up their usual deodorant off the shelf. They know exactly what they want, they go for it, grab it, and they're gone. Others are less sure. They cannot find the right one right away, and they get into what seems to be a long time of comparison and internal debate. In fact, they spend an inordinate amount of time stealing peeks at the other guy's cards, seeing what they've got. My theory, men, is that it's not the hearts and flowers that are so tough about this endeavor. It's the expression of sentiment that's contained in the cards. I hope you tell your wife that you love her. I hope you tell her that often. But I don't know too many of us who are used to telling our wives that we love them like Valentine Day cards tell our wives they are loved. That is, with an undying love, or with an eternal love, or with an infinite love. Now, in fact, I think it's fair to say that men are cautious about overstatement. We tend to be suspicious of those who exaggerate. And some of us have become masters of understatement, saying, in fact, that you do anything infinitely is not part of a man's vocabulary. Now, I'm already a little uncomfortable with the gender stereotypical nature of what I'm saying, so let me switch and be a bit more inclusive. From experience, sometimes hard experience, many of us have become aware about saying more than we mean. In fact, many of us, men and women, we have learned that it is far better to say less and deliver more than to promise too much on the front end. And so we're cautious about using words like infinite, whether it's on Valentine's Day cards or in describing the number of moves that Emmett Smith can make. Part of the reason, I would suggest, is that we're not entirely sure what a word like infinite means. For example, in what I just said, if Emmett did have an infinite number of moves, we would probably be talking about the quantity of his running patterns. But if I have infinite love for my wife, it's not so much the quantity, the amount of love that I'm talking about, but rather the quality of the love. In either case, when we use the word infinite, we're talking about something without limits. And in either case, we're talking about something that is not very human. And because infinite love, or infinite anything else for that matter, isn't very human, we usually reserve words like infinite for God. But then there's another problem. When we speak about God and we talk about Him being infinite, sometimes our eyes glaze over. For such a term seems to be rather abstract and remote and distant from where we live. But now I'm getting really to my point. The Bible does describe God as infinite, that is, without any limits whatsoever. But it does so in a way that keeps our eyes from glazing over, because it does it in a way that relates to us quite personally. And this is what I want us to see this morning in David's psalm about God's infinity, which is what I want to suggest to you Psalm 139 really is. A psalm about a God without any limits. But David doesn't talk in abstractions with long words that make our eyes glaze over. No, he speaks very personally. So personally that I would suggest to you that it's hard for you or me to imagine ever saying these words about ourselves in someone else's hearing. Now remember that a psalm is a poem. And so it is the language of personal poetry that we have here, which isn't just for girls, men, at least not David's poetry, because David's poetry is manly and full of strength and honesty and honor and blood and guts. In this psalm, God relates to me very personally. His infinity touches me. And it's the meeting of the infinite God and the finite me that occasions David's wonder. The God without any limits is deeply involved in all the limitations of my life. And this is what David wants us to see. And I would suggest to you that there is, if you look at this psalm, a very neat outline, roughly in three sections with an ending that brings it all together. In the first section, David talks about God's knowledge of me is without limits. That's verses 1 through 6. In the second section, roughly verses 7 through 12, he speaks of God's presence being without limits. And in a third section, roughly verses 13 through 18, he speaks of God's power without limits. And then, as we'll see in a few moments, he brings it all to a somewhat startling conclusion. First then, God's knowledge of me is without any limits. Now, rather than saying God knows everything, David says in verse 1, O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. Not only does God know everything, but he knows it about me. And the implication, therefore, is that God is not in the infinite knowledge business, but rather he is in the business of knowing me infinitely, completely, without any limitations. Verse 6, David says there that such knowledge is too wonderful for him, too lofty for him to attain. He's really saying that God's knowledge of him is not only without limit, it is also infinitely more than it is even good or right for me to know about myself. He is saying that God knows more, much more, about me than I know about me. And what David is really saying in this section is that to know yourself is important, yes, but it is much more important to know that you are known by God. It's more important to know that you are known by God than it is to know yourself. That's what he's saying. And this may seem subtle, but I think it's really important. It is only as I am known by another that I come to see myself reflected back to myself in a way that helps me know who I am. Think about it, those of you who are married, and surely one of the greatest privileges of our marriages is that reflected back to myself in the life and face and demeanor and manner of my husband or wife, is a reflection of me that enables me to understand more of who I am. Or think of it in terms of a very human level in another way. When I am known, truly known, by another person who is, shall we say, better than me, a person who is morally superior, a person with great honor, a person who is perhaps older, and a person that I admire, when I see myself reflected back in that person's knowing me, I come to know myself better, don't I? Think of the coach who cares for a young athlete and knows him so well, or of an older woman who sits down at her kitchen table with coffee together with a younger woman, or a businessman who takes the time to mentor a younger man in the trade. Each of these people grows to understand themselves better through the life and through the sight of themselves, as it were, that another person has of them. Well, infinitely more than any coach or friend or mentor, God's knowing of me is without any limit. And since He knows me better than I know myself, it is only as I know this God that I know myself accurately. And that is really at the heart of what David is saying, especially in this first section. You don't know who you are until you know the God who knows you so well that it is in His own revelation of Himself to you that you come to learn things about yourself you could not know otherwise. And David says that God's unlimited knowledge means that He knows when David sits and when he stands, when he moves, when he goes. He knows what David is thinking. He even knows what David is going to say before he says it. But it's not that David feels scrutinized. The point isn't that God is some kind of celestial snoop. The point is that as God's searching knowledge of David penetrates ever deeper into his life, David feels what? Read the psalm again. What does he feel? He feels accepted. He feels loved. He feels that the one who has unlimited knowledge and the ability to know all things from beginning to end knows him so deeply, and yet he accepts him. And this is really the source of David's wonder. He says, in effect, how can God, who knows me so well without any limits, still want to know me? If He really knows all my thoughts and all my actions and all my words before they ever take place, and He knows those things and their motives better than I know them myself, how is it that God can stay committed to me? And yet he says in verse 17, how precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. And there is a note of wonder in that last phrase. David is saying, quite frankly, when I wake up, God, I expect you to be gone because you know me so well. When I wake up, I expect you to have left me. I mean, after all, God, you know me so well. I expect you not to be here. But the wonder of wonders is that when I wake up, you are still with me. So David marvels in the fact that God's knowledge of him is without limits. And David comes to know himself in and through God's own knowledge of him in a way he simply never could have otherwise. Then in the second place, God's presence is without limits. Not only is His knowledge without limits, but His presence with David is without any limits. The older theologians rightly said that God is infinite in His being, by which they meant a couple of 50-cent words that we don't use very much. One is the word immense. That means that God transcends all spatial limitations. And the other one is omnipresent. That is to say that God is present in every point in space with his whole being all the time. That's worthy of a thought or two. David's way of thinking about God's infinite being, his presence without limits, is again very personal. Look at verse 7. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. David's point is not just that God is everywhere at once, which he accepts as a given, but rather that God's having no limits on his presence means that David does not go anywhere where God is not, and where God does not and cannot find him. Look at verse 11. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light becomes night around me, even the darkness will be not dark to you. These verses inspired Francis Thompson to write a poem that's perhaps familiar to many of you called The Hound of Heaven. I fled him down the nights and down the days, Thompson says. So David is saying that through the grid of his own living, that God's infinite presence is hardly an abstraction at all. No, God is not just everywhere. He is everywhere finding me. God is never so remote that he will not be with me where I am to find me and to help me in all the comings and goings of my life. Look at verse 9. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. So what David realizes as he explores the vastness of the universe in his imagination, and he finds out that he can't go anywhere where God is not, what he realizes is that he cannot hide from God. But even more, he comes to know that it's not so much that he is pursued by God as that God awaits him in every place he goes. And that God awaits him there, not to pin him down as an enemy, as perhaps Absalom does, the one from whom he's running in the context of writing this psalm. God doesn't await for him to pin him down as an enemy, but God awaits for him to support him, to hold him fast with his right hand. So the issue is not just you can run but you can't hide from God. Rather, the issue is God is waiting for you at your tomorrow morning. God is waiting for you at what you face this week. God is waiting for you as you deal with a nasty personnel situation at work tomorrow morning. He is waiting for you as you go back to the classroom where someone was perhaps a bully or mean to you. He waits for you as you pursue a new job because you've lost your old one. He waits for you this week in the uncertain and unwelcome visit you must pay to a doctor's office, perhaps to hear bad news. David is saying that it's not so much that God creates these situations, though he does, but it is rather that he is waiting for me in these situations. You hem me in behind and before, he says. Even there, even in your Monday mornings, your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. So God's knowledge is without limits. And God's presence with you is without limits in the very situations that fill your life, many of which may be troublesome, many of which may be hard. But the wonder of this poetry is that it sings the praises of a God who is there in that situation. Not only with me, but he got there before I did. And he's preparing himself
to receive me into that situation?
Well, third, we must say then that God's power is without limits. Not only is his knowledge and not only is his presence without limits, but also his power is without limits. God's infinite knowledge of me and his infinite presence around me and with me is most personally expressed by God's infinite power in creating me. Verse 13. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Since God is infinite in his knowledge of us and his presence with us, it would be understandable if he ignored us, or even if he destroyed us. For certainly the more he knows of us and the more places he is with us, the more reason he has to cast us off. But God's power was in the making of us, not the undoing of us. Didn't you feel that when those three lovely people stood and read the scripture here this morning? Three very different people in different stages of their lives, all of them bearing witness to the truth that God formed me in my mother's womb. And so David says, I am fearfully made. What does that mean? What could it possibly mean to say that God fearfully makes anything? The word fear, as it's most often used in the Old Testament especially, is not a reference to quaking in fear. It's a reference to reverence. God made me with reverence. If I could put it this way, God worshiped himself as he made me. And then we read verse 15. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. My frame, my physical body, my inmost being, my inner person, God crafted from scratch by perfect design and with infinite power, so that I can say with David humbly and with awe, but nevertheless I can say it, I am wonderfully made. And all the mars and all the imperfections that I look at when I look in the mirror in the morning, all of the things that profoundly make me insecure, all of the things that I wish I could change, all of the things that people spend thousands of dollars going to cosmetic surgeons for, God made me that way. And if you would think about that, I think you will find a basis for security as you're in your own personhood that is the best basis for security of them all. And so we really must not let it go unsaid that if in fact I was wonderfully made and knit together in my mother's womb, then any choice to end a pregnancy without rightful medical cause seeks to tamper with the infinite creative power of God. And that in the end, it is not the taking of life that is so wrong. It is the usurping of God's power. It is that we play God. And here is where we must be sober indeed. How long will a God who is infinite in his knowledge of us, who is infinite in his presence with us and his creative power over us, how long can he tolerate our attempted coups? Whether it's abortion or euthanasia or arrogance at our own importance in the scheme of things, The God that David knows and describes in this psalm would be a paper tiger if he forever tolerated our pretending to be him. I've mentioned God's infinite knowledge and his presence and his power, but it also could be said that God is infinitely patient. But like other finite things about God, that does not mean he has an unlimited amount of patience, but rather that the quality of his patience is without limitation or defect. And this is why I think David can be so blunt as he comes to the end of the psalm, and to say something which is frankly quite startling to our ears, as he speaks about those who are against God and against his kingdom, and he speaks about them so bluntly that we almost want to figure out a way to skip this part of the psalm. If only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. That God, in his knowledge of me, in his presence with me, and in his power over me and over all of created life, is so much without limits that any human tampering with God's infinity must ultimately meet with God's judgment. But that isn't where he ends. Instead, he pulls all the threads of what he's been saying back to himself in the last verses and says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." David is saying, I'm in constant need of knowing you, a God who knows me without limits. I'm in constant need, Lord, of finding you in all of my tomorrows. I'm in constant need of finding you in all of the places where I will go and knowing that you there wait for me. I'm in constant need of knowing the reality of your power in my life because, oh God, without you, I cannot even know myself. So search me, oh God. Search me, please. Please search me. Because if you don't search me, I have no light to search myself. And I can't know myself. Oh God, know me, know me.